welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, Judith Madison will be speaking on divorce, pain, and healing. So let's listen in on Judith.
My name is Judith Madison. I am a pastor in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the title of this session is Divorce, the Pain, and the Healing. When I came to Holden in 1980 for the first time, my marriage was in shreds, and we were in heavy-duty counseling at that time, just trying to figure out what would happen next for us. And the following year, then, we were separated and divorced in early 1982. Since I had written many books over the years, some people thought I might write about that, and I said, no, I didn't think so. Because it would seem to me that that was, first of all, that John had to be considered. That was my husband's name. And I couldn't be just writing stuff willy-nilly and publishing it. And then, though, as I began to listen to people over the next couple of years, I realized that there are universals in this experience. And so that I wouldn't, in fact, be writing just about us, although I did, but I would be writing about many people and about many people's experiences, which I have put together in this book, and the title is The Divorce, the Pain, and the Healing. And if my box ever gets here, it will be in the bookstore. We can all pray that my box will get here because it also has bar soap in it. But. But you can at least purchase that in the bookstore as well. And my style usually is to read from the book in a conversational kind of way and tie some ideas I have together about divorce. But what I would like to have you do is insert any opinions and questions and so on that you have as we move along. So I hope you'll just feel free, just interrupt. It's perfectly okay. The one thing I guess I have always known about divorce is that it's a roller coaster of emotions. Sometimes there's this enormous sense of relief after the pressure is kind of off, and then there are all those other things that come along, the loneliness and the anger and so on and so forth. And if we move through any experience in life, that's what's at root, it seems to me, for everything. We can think our way through a lot of things, and some of us are more thinkers than feelers, as we say. But the reality is that the thing that will set our equilibrium off will be emotions at some level. And we can't always just think our way through anger, for example. I had been in a marriage for 19 years when that divorce became final. And we had two sons who were teenagers. And it was a gradual kind of experience in the sense of watching a marriage dissolve. Being a pastor's wife, as I was at that time, there was a tremendous sense of pressure not to do this, that this would be a wrong thing to do. We promised a covenant in church for better, worse, richer, poorer, sickness, health, until death. We broke the promise. Yet being together was death for both of us. We were no longer healthy. Today we have another chance to live again. Still, it's hard to break a promise. No matter what I'd been doing, it was always when I began to drive back home that my jaw clenched tight. I carried the weight of our relationship clutched in my head, my chest, and my arms. Finally, my teeth began to ache, and my stomach couldn't hold food. I hurt, my whole body hurt, from the tension of trying and trying and trying. My body knew it couldn't be done. And that's literally what happened, was that I went to the doctor saying, I'm just having a lot of trouble, and he was able to identify that maybe something else was wrong besides physical things. The things that I, of course, was not wanting to acknowledge. And so we did a considerable amount of counseling. And perhaps the thing we did, quote, best was keep the children at the focus of what we were doing. We were both just terrified, I guess, to tell our kids that things weren't working, because one of the problems in our marriage was we didn't talk. We didn't fight. Our kids would have had no clue that their parents didn't have a real good relationship, because we didn't put it out there, which is exactly why the relationship fell apart. So what I've learned, of course, from the, and hopefully we learn from all these things, what I've learned is things have to be on the table in a relationship. And we have to either fight it out or talk it through. Our children accept us as mom and dad without much qualification. And if you think about it, that's true. Our kids just kind of accept us. We're kind of lucky. I can remember my kids saying, "Oh, Dad," you know, or "Mom, that's so dumb." But basically, they accepted us just the way we were, and they didn't make those judgments. They only want to feel secure, loved by both, rather than forced to choose or support a particular parent's point of view. It is immensely unfair to ask them to judge a parent using a mate's adult standards. Let children love both of the people who created them. For the children's sake, we will not blame or ask them to reject a parent. We are adults. We can cooperate for the children's sake. Now, we don't always cooperate after a divorce, and sometimes it gets very testy. But that can be kept, I think, away from the children to a large extent. And we can set up situations in which we blame the other parent and kind of be indirectly pointing out to the kids, "You see, I told you. He doesn't come through. She isn't doing this right," whatever it is. And that's not fair to kids, because they can't make that judgment. They still want to be with their dad some of the time and just know that he loves them, and the same is true for their mom. So we have to rise above that, I think, in the process of divorce. Do you have comments?
I do, too. My observation, I've done over 700 divorces as an attorney, and so two concepts. One, you put out that as a pastor's wife, you felt extra pain for having to go through this. And I don't know, in my experience, anybody that has more or less pain because of their occupation or their standing in society. Either, like, you know, for you, I would assume there was a congregational pressure and family and such, but most people I run into have family or other societal pressure on them. And then you mentioned the promise of marriage, and I quite frankly don't know any promise that is sacred anymore in our society. Marriage is, you know, results in an enormous amount of divorce. If it's a promise, "I'll be there tonight," that's easy, that's within 12 hours. I rarely come across a promise that's sustained through a lifetime anymore. And that just impacts me. It's like, you know, this is as good, well, I'll promise you today until something better comes. And I've also been divorced, so I'm not just being an asshole. But you know, I just don't see that, you know, we make lifetime commitments to anything, generally.
And it's made you kind of cynical about how, whether or not people will be able to make those commitments.
Cynical is one way, or more of a realist. Like, I'll accept your attempt, but I will not hold you to completion of that.
Mm.
I'll accept your attempt. You know, in so many ways, you know, I promise I'll always be there for you, the parent says to the child. Well, there'll come a time where the parent won't be there for the child,
mm-hmm.
Vice versa. So that's just observation.
Thanks. I didn't want to sound as if I think it's more painful for a pastor's family, because it's just that that was the pressure that we felt, was the pressure of example. We were supposed to be setting an example for people and not living up to that.
I just want to have you back up a little bit and ask you. You mentioned going to the doctor. I'm a physician. I have men who are in the middle of this don't come to us. The women basically do, and they come with physical symptoms, and they're not hard to identify because they don't make sense, and a lot of times they're clearly kind of psychosomatic and stress related, and you have to, and sometimes they won't admit that there's this stuff going on. You have to bring them back a couple of times and try to pull back, doing too many tests on them, just try to get them to talk. So, but one of the things that's hard for me is how do you know when it's still salvageable? And sometimes people, and I've had this both professionally with friends, you know, you're astounded sometimes to find out your friends and some of your patients are going through this. I often wondered with people that I know real well, what happens first here? I mean, you mentioned lack of communication, but what happens first? And at what point do you just forget trying to save it?
Mm-hmm. And I've seen marriages that I thought would never pull through. When the trust had been, I think trust is so basic, and when the trust had been disrupted, and still they did. So I don't give up quickly anymore. You know, I didn't give up quickly. First of all, I worked on it for about 10 years trying to figure this thing out.
One of the reasons I asked that is because I've also been impressed that there's not that many people who go through a divorce and wind up a whole lot happier than they were before. There's some, certainly there's plenty, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people wind up, and the problem is not that they don't find another person that maybe they can relate to better, but the problems with the kids, the problems with the money, the problems with the property get to be so onerous that it adds such another layer of unhappiness on their lives and stress. Mm-hmm. And you wonder if it's really worth it, and they wonder if it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it would be helpful, you talked about being a realist. It's always helpful when we can talk with people to raise in some fashion those realistic problems that lie ahead. And money clearly is one of them. In fact, let me just use this. The fact is there's less money now. Everyone lives with less and wonders more. It's an additional irritation to an otherwise perplexing time. Blame and greed set in, and I find myself envying not only you, meaning the husband, but friends and strangers who are not so troubled. It's no wonder Jesus spoke so often about money. We are accustomed to having what we want, and now we must temper even our wishes for what we want. I turn to friends to get perspective, to the Gospel of Luke, and to God. The other piece of that is that I observed in our relationship, or perhaps more in others, that when we are at a place where we're trying to separate out years of interwoven life, memories and all of that stuff, the one thing that seems real clear is the piano. That's not so messed up with all those other things, and the records, or whatever it is, you can divide that stuff out, and it becomes symbolic of the relationship. And so all of a sudden, the piano, which was just a piece of furniture in the house, becomes very important because it represents everything else, all kinds of memories, good memories or bad memories. And then we start to quarrel over that, and we start to feel hurt, which is usually anger, just twisted around a little bit. And we start to stake our life on silverware instead of on relationship. And having decided to give up a relationship, what we fail to recognize is exactly what you've said. The relationship never ends. One can leave the partner, but the relationship never ends. It just changes. You just have to get along in different ways, usually. Some people can take off to separate parts of the country and never see each other again, but that's pretty rare. So you are kind of stuck working it through in new ways. Sometimes, though, those ways are easier because you can recognize in each other, you can accept sometimes the differences in each other which before were threatening or difficult to deal with. Things that someone found hard to live with. Now, if you don't have to live with them, you can just sort of brush them away and deal with other portions of your life together. We, as I said, we had two sons, and one of them was about 12, and the other 14. when the young one was maybe 10, this experience happened. "You'll never get a divorce, will you?" my son asked me when he was 9. "No," I assured him, but I wasn't sure. I prayed that it would never happen, but it did. He was sad and frightened, suggesting that he and his brother move out for a while so that we could work things out. He blamed himself. I told him it wasn't his fault, but then I recalled that once I also told him it would never happen. It makes me cry to remember we let them down. And this is the child who went out and sat under the tree. That day when we told him a Sunday morning after church, he didn't say anything for a long time, because that's the way he is. And he just sat and thought, and then he came up with a suggestion that maybe if he and Ted moved out of the house for a while, Dad and Mother could get along better, as if they were the problem. Now in later years, many years later, I have often apologized to my boys for the breakup of that marriage, because I still carry some guilt and sadness over it. And this is the child, though, who says to me, "You know, people who don't ever have anything hard that happens to them probably don't know much about life." And he said, "Maybe having something like that happen wasn't the worst thing," which I find very wonderful and forgiving of him. His brother, who's 14, also has put that into perspective very well, because they were able to maintain a relationship with their dad, for one thing. My older son, 14, called me home whenever I stayed at a friend's too long. This was like if I stopped at some friend's on the way home from church. And if it got to almost 10 o'clock, the phone would ring. And Ted wanted me to come home. It was annoying. I wasn't very late, and I needed time away. But I went home to be with him. Now I've learned that children of divorce fear the added loss of their home parent after the other parent moves away. They need security. He needed to know I would stay. It only lasted for a while, but however long it might have lasted, I'm glad I went home to be with him. One learns a great deal about oneself and about relationships and about kids in this process. If you have comments, just let me know. At some point, I was able to put myself into the place of my husband and realize what it is to move out of the house, even if you do take some of the stuff with you, and not have that anchor of the family, which he had been accustomed to. He came from a good, solid family. And and Ted would, I can remember the boys would go to see, we had joint custody, and so we had this arrangement where they would go to stay with him. And Ted would grumble on the way out, because he always kept his feelings right on the surface. He's carrying his pillow. "Oh, I don't even have a pillow over this place. I'm always having to pack up and go." Which was always better than Michael's silence. And because the first day when Ted heard, he was furious. "What do you mean?" He was mad at us. I was so grateful he was mad. It was easier to handle. This is called the non-custodial parent. It's lonely leaving the children and going home alone. I'm sometimes afraid they'll forget me, lose interest. resent my absence, blame me. I wonder if there's something I should be doing for them. When we're together, it's hard to act naturally. It takes a while to begin to talk. This is an awkward time. Perhaps it's best to talk candidly about it with the children. If each one can say the truth, we can feel closer and begin to go on. We'll often be separated, but inwardly united because our shared emotions bind us together. Children are at different ages, and so whether they can discuss how they feel about different things varies. But I do think that that's true, that we sort of try to recreate the past for the kids. And it might be better to just talk about the present with the kids and say, this is the way it is now. And this is what's hard about it. A woman spoke with me once. She was the non-custodial parent. And I told her about another woman I knew who was the custodial parent, and she would say of her husband, well, he's kind of a Disneyland dad. He gets to pick them up, take them out for pizza, they go to a movie or do something fun, bring them home, and I'm the one who has to see if they get their homework done and they close the door quietly, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the other woman said, being that Disneyland mom isn't so great either, because you always wonder if you've done enough. And in this little piece of time, will you have shown them enough that you love them? And will you have established enough of a relationship so that they'll come to you sometime if they have trouble? And she said that was easily as big a burden as it was to have them day in and day out. That's why the book is called The Pain. Divorce, the Pain, and the Healing. One of the things that happens to the adult, of course, is often a change of self-image. And in some ways, that was very beneficial. One discovers a lot of things that you can do that you didn't know. On the other hand, what I did, I wouldn't recommend. Shortly after the separation, I started seminary. And so I was going to seminary full-time and working 30 hours a week with these two teenage boys at home. And I got so sick of change, I could scream. And that's what I remember saying. I talked to myself in the car. I just hope that people think that there's a baby in the back seat. driving down the ramp of the freeway, I'm saying, I'm sick of change. And then later wrote exactly that. I'm sick of change. New ways of managing money, of repairing machines, washing clothes, eating dinners. New experiences meeting people, entering places alone, looking for someone to talk to, wondering what happened to old friends. New view of myself, how I've been insensitive, discovering untapped talents, thinking of myself as single, surprising myself with emotions. Life is so unfamiliar at times, and I get tired of adjusting, readjusting, thinking about myself and my life. I long for familiar routine. Change is exhausting, yet exhilarating. I pause to wonder, who would I have been without this change? I'm tired, but it's worth the discovery. Now, I'm one of those people who would say there was no question that that was the right decision for me to have been divorced. It changed my life dramatically and in positive ways. Although it was a lot of work, that thing about thinking all the time. You spend the first 4 years just thinking about everything, and then it begins to fall into place. Yeah.
Why can't that change take place before it gets that bad?
Yeah, that's the question.
Did you come up with any answer?
Well, in my case, probably that change couldn't happen because of the relationship holding it back. That I hadn't been able somehow to discover for myself who I was in the relationship. And I kept pushing the relationship to try to make it accommodate both of us and couldn't. So that was what was hard about it.
Well, I'm divorced. I've been divorced for 10 years. But I think in my relationship, I started to change. And then my husband he just wanted to stay the same. And
yeah.
You know, I mean, he was never going to change. And the children and I, well, two of my children, my oldest daughter did not get any counseling. I mean, we went into counseling, and I actually was the person who moved out of the house when they were 12, 13, and 16. And I never lived on my own, and I had to, you know, I had no dog, no kids, no husband, no neighborhood. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it really, then I started to grow up and really make some significant changes. But if one person changes and the other person doesn't ever want to work on the relationship, like one person that I went to this relationship talk, and he said, you know, you can be playing a game of tennis, and if you're serving the ball and the person is sitting in the chair and you keep throwing the ball, serving the ball, and they never serve it back, you don't have a relationship. And I don't know, I also remember that.
It's a good image.
I have a difficult time with what you were saying about the children, because I think I've been divorced 10 years, and I think my boys are angry about it as they look at the loss of the dream. Mm. You know, the fact that they have to go over to their dads, and it interrupts their schedules, and it interrupts what they can do. Not that they don't love their father and want to be with him, and you know, it's no awful situation, but it just, it interrupts their life and it makes it hard. You know, I hope they'll be able to say at some point, you know, that they appreciate that it was hard, but it was okay. Because right now they're 12 and 10, and it seems real difficult to hear that negative stuff come up once in a while. I feel a little guilty about handing them a life that started this way.
I think that makes a big difference how old they are. Their ability to kind of reason through that is significantly different from my boys, who are now 26 and 29. So they've had their 10 years were at an older age. So I hope for you too that that will come. The loss of the dream is very great to everyone. I can remember the day my husband was remarried. I said to someone, "Why do I care? You know, I don't dislike him. On the other hand, I'm not invested in him in the same way. Why does this bother me?" And she said, "Because now, for sure, the family is done." And that was true. Up until then, we had this sort of unseen thread that held us together. And then it was over and had to be new.
And don't you think, for myself, I think I look back and I lost the dream is lost, but it was never there. It was kind of an Ozzie and Harriet thing that I wanted. And so it never was there within the family. I was always trying to achieve that. And then you get a divorce and you don't have a chance to even realize the dream that you didn't have. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, I didn't have it, but I miss it. You know, type, it's kind of a...
And it says, excuse me, it says a lot about how we were raised,
right,
and how we think about marriage and how we ought to be talking about it in other people's presence, and especially with our children and grandchildren now. Those of us who came out of, and I recognize not everyone is in this group, came out of the 50s, it was Ozzie and Harriet, and probably the 60s, Leave It to Beaver or whatever. That notion of how family should look. And I think if we owe our progeny anything, it is to help them be more realistic about what it means to enter into a relationship and commit at all costs, so that they wait a while and think things over before they move ahead, which many of them are doing. I'm not sure they're thinking them over, but they're waiting a while anyway. I can tell by the way they say single that people feel sorry for me. Some of them promise, "You'll find someone again." And others tease, "Have you met a nice person yet?" There's implicit in their words the idea that marriage is better and single is less than. It makes me wonder how always single people feel in a coupled society. I wonder how much the expectations of people having to be married influenced my decision to marry and confused my thoughts of divorce. I'm still a whole person. I still like basketball and reading and snow and dinners out and children, sunshine, my work. I'm not less than. I'm me. Single is not inadequate. It's like all of life. Bittersweet and good and rich and full of God. Sadness, promise, fear. People need not feel sorry for me. I do remember the one woman who said over and over again at church, she's the only one who ever really did this to me. She'd say, aren't you married yet? Have you found any nice fellow? And my sense of it was that it had, that those were barbs coming at me, and that they came from a person who was scared to death that she would ever have to live alone. That was just guessing, but that's how it felt to me.
I have long since thought of myself as a single divorced person. I mean, I don't on a day-to-day basis even think about that. I just live, and occasionally it comes to me that that's the lifestyle that I now have. I do want to talk a little about some of those emotions we mentioned earlier. And maybe I'll just flip through some, and then if you have some ideas. This is interesting. This is a book from the library, and someone has gone through it and highlighted places and added words. So I have right here an edited copy of my own work. Yeah, it is. And I'd love to know who it is. I'm sometimes amazed at my anger. Whatever has gone before, I'm surprised to find so much residue of hostility and anger now. It's a sign of the investment I've made in your behavior and welfare, and how it is so entangled in mine. I'm glad for friends who hear me out, and for the one who gave me that pillow to hit. I remember with relief the anger of Jesus and David and Moses. I can pretend it isn't mine, but it comes seeping out one way or another. Let it go. Don't injure. Don't deny. Separation and divorce are full of anger. See, I was not an angry person, of course. I didn't think. So I had to change my self-image and get real. We meet on the street by chance, once legally related, now related only by the past, memories, struggles, laughter, and the confidence of trust that comes with years of being family together. We laugh again, talk, quickly share news, and promise to have lunch, and then you are gone, and I sigh. Loss. It will never be the same again. This is called rejection. It is triggered at times by music. Some days it comes when I watch another couple, young or old, walking hand in hand and sharing together. It stings. I feel rejected. I had as much to do with this choice as you, yet I cannot help but feel I am less, inadequate to your needs. You have left me and I feel alone and rejected. Finding someone else to fill the hollow is a temporary solution. I must live with and overcome rejection so that I may begin again. For some reason, in the middle of that, I began to think about your sons, your children who are younger and who are missing the dream. And it occurred to me that they may need another place to talk about that. I guess when I read this about friends, sometimes it's good to get some outside help so that they have a place where they can say all that and you don't get hurt quite so badly by it or guilt-ridden.
In the words that you've read and what people have said, it's reinforced the pain of divorce, but your book is pain and healing.
Yeah, I'd like to get to that. And you would too. Okay, let me just do this one and then... And then we'll start to move in that direction. Self-recrimination. I argue with myself, it was my fault. No, I'm not to blame. Yes, I am. I could have done this. I should have been that. Maybe I just didn't try hard enough, long enough. And I sigh. I can't relive the past, nor find a simple route through a maze of life experiences, as if there is an easy answer to what happened to us. When I'm tired or prone to doubt, I blame myself. The easy way out. It is self-recrimination, self-destruction, and it keeps me from going on. In moving toward the healing, I think an essential part of that is to have looked at all of those feelings that we have had, all those emotions, and not run away from them. One of the ones that's easy to try to avoid is loneliness. And I think that might be especially true in the beginning. Sometimes I'm lonely. It can happen on Sunday afternoon, Saturday night, or even in the middle of a crowd. What matters is what I do. It is not always necessary to run away from loneliness. Busy, busy, meet the gang, go to a movie, call a friend. Sometimes I just wait a while and it passes. Loneliness is part of any life. Other times it's important to move out of my lethargy and find company. Self-pity is useless and tiring, and there are people waiting for my phone call, or a letter, or a visit for an hour. Loneliness is not an enemy, but a moment to be lived. I have discovered myself as I meet loneliness and use it to learn about life. There was a man who was a recovering person. I don't know if he had made it that far, really. He was an alcoholic, and he would call his sponsor and say, "I'm so lonely," and kind of want to talk and feel bad, and feeling bad. And his sponsor would say, "You may be lonely for 20 minutes, and then you have to do something." Which was probably good, realistic stuff to push a person. That loneliness thing easily sinks into depression. Another beginning of change is to kind of face that we have to get over it. Some of us carry our anger a long time. What does anger give us if we're carrying it a long time?
Illness, spiritual and physical illness.
Yep, it really can become sick. On the other side, it can give us energy. Sometimes if you can muster your anger, you get a little more energy to keep going. Because anger is a way of pushing at depression. So some people, I think, foster their anger in order to keep enough energy to push on. But it still ends up being, that's a negative way to do that.
I understand that depression at times is anger turned inwards.
Yeah.
So there's, and you could say there's a healthy type of anger, but you can take your anger to a very unhealthy state.
Mm-hmm.
I was approached by someone after a presentation who started to relate a scenario related to their divorce. And I said, well, you know, thinking like a lawyer, I said, well, how long ago was it? You know, I was thinking of appeals and stuff. And with vehement anger, said, 10 years, you know? It's like, it was a sucking chest wound, you know? I mean, it had not healed at all. And that life was molded imperfectly by that anger. So you got to work through it.
And I'll come to you in a minute. Part of that, I believe, is one reason we would hold on to anger is if we don't want to take responsibility for our part in the breakdown of the relationship. Then if we can stay angry at the partner, then it appears that the partner is always to blame. And we haven't worked through that blame part, the self-recrimination part.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what was the real healing experience for me is after like 2 years of kind of, I mean, I was working, but I was in this kind of depression. I mean, I was functioning and so forth, but, you know, I was sort of like working. That kind of was a way to escape. Mm-hmm. And I went back to school. And so I was very busy. But then I went on this vacation to Florida, and I was by myself, and I was doing a lot of crying and so forth. And then I wrote a letter to John, that was my husband, and it was all about me and the relationship. I mean, like, I looked at my whole, it had nothing to do with him. It was just all about me and the things about me in the relationship. And I mailed that letter to him. I mean, there was no accusing of him. It was just everything that I saw about myself and, you know, my different ways of acting and so forth. And it was like I mailed that letter, and then I was able to move on with my life. I don't know, for me, and I walked the beach and I cried and I did all this stuff, and it was just like very healing. And I really then started to move on, and I started noticing people. I sort of started looking at men. I mean, I got on the plane and I thought, oh, there's men in the world. It was like, I know, I mean, that's how it was for me, and I just didn't even notice. Not that I wanted to go right out and have sex or date or anything, but it was just like, these nice-looking men were getting on the plane in suits, and then I sort of was able to start doing some more things with my life. But
that's why our liturgy is set up the way it is. We do confession first. And when we can get through that and and kind of accept the absolution, then we can move on. Then we move on to the praise and all the rest of life. But we have to start in the pit, so to speak, and say, this is who I've been. I think it's great that you wrote that letter, and it wouldn't matter if you had sent it or not, even. Just that you came to that yourself.
Yeah, and I didn't expect him to call me up and say, oh, well, you finally looked at yourself. I mean, it was, I had no idea what to do with it or what, anything, and that was fine.
Mm-hmm. It was, that was really growth for you. Confession.
I would think one of the hard parts, and I'm still talking about pain here, would be, when you're talking about kids, would be to for the kids to relate to your ex's new spouse. How does that work out? I mean, most of the time.
Very differently in different situations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then your kids have kids, and then your grandparents all the stuff that that must be.
That's, and I've known grandparents who just ache terribly over the divorce of their children. And then this mix up with the grandchildren.
Because they can shut out some.
Yeah.
Well, I had an experience as an adult with my father dying when I was 35 and when my mother remarried. And that was real hard for me, you know, because we met then his children, and then, you know, my mother was sort of starting to say, I mean, I'm 35 years old now, and my mother's saying, trying to tell me that I'm supposed to call him dad. I mean, she was sort of like pushing this, and I'm sure that's what happens with the younger kids too. Neither my husband or I have, ex-husband, have ever remarried, which I'm sort of surprised that he hasn't. But I'm sure, like you say, even though it's been a long time, when he does remarry, it'll seem strange.
And I think what you're raising here too is that we really are in new times. If you were to go through this village or any elementary school and ask how many of those children have come from families that are blended or where divorce has happened, you'd be amazed at the numbers. And I was talking with a youngster here who I've known from Holden for many years. She's 17 now. And she's here with her dad. And she comes every year. But 1 year it's with her mom, and the next year it's with her dad. Well, she said, you get used to it. Family is not what we thought it was anymore. I don't know if we dare even hold that up as an ideal. I can't take that away. But family is much more than that now. Family has to do with the way people relate to each other, not with the configuration of the family. I still think father, mother, children is a wonderful configuration, but there are many others, and those relationships vary greatly.
When people remarry, do they tend to solve the problems that were created the first time around, or are they open to some more problems again?
It depends a lot on the people, I think.
So. Is there any purport, I mean, has there been any studies that shows a percentage that, of those that are able to overcome the problems of the first marriage?
I'm sure there are, and I wouldn't know them. Yeah, I'm sure there is some study of that. I can tell you that most men marry within a couple of years, 2 years. Women less so.
Your comments earlier about the children and stuff, I'm aware of a number of kind of general studies on children and then the dynamics. If it's like if dad has custody and he has a daughter, what's the likelihood of success in a new marriage for that dad? It's real high. It's not high because of the dynamics. So they do break them down. And then you get out to the extended family, the grandparents and all. It can be very difficult or it can be very nurturing depending upon the parent's divorce. But there's all sorts of kind of categories, and it's like, give me your family scenario, and I'll slot you in, and here's some studies, and God bless. But what you were saying about, like, the family, mom, dad, child, I hear that, and I know that's common. I challenge you on that, because the majority of families, of children in school, are still from that mom, dad, kid, the majority of them. It's in the low 50% in the United States. So if we say, well, if we keep saying, well, you know, if we continue to support the minority, which is the blended family or single parent, we're making it easier. And so I, for my children so far, we're blessed with Ozzie and Harriet situation, and I hope to maintain that. But the majority still are there. But we have everybody saying, well, you know, blended family, single parent, that's kind of what we got to take care of. Well, we should also be nurturing the mom and dad, the Ozzie and Harriet.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think we ought to, in the church, be holding up marriages that last for... We ought to really celebrate these marriages that are 50 years, even 25, whatever it is, so that... People look to that as something to work toward, rather than, yes, I'm sorry if I said that, you don't want to give up on what is, in my opinion, still the better choice.
Yes, that's one of the reasons I asked about where does it start? Where does it stop being salvageable? Because it seems to me that most of the marriages break up, usually not over other people, sex, stuff you might, I think most of them are, I think the reason the divorce rate's so high, just kind of subjectively from what I can see, is that one spouse just isn't able to do what they want to do in the marriage. And there's not communication and freedom to be the person they want to be within the confines of the marriage. And in the old days, that's just what they had to put up with, and some marriages survived. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have to look at is if we're going to foster healthy marriages, how do you get, we have to get people to be able to realize that they can live their lives out in the way they want within marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And not run up against their spouse all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky.
It goes both ways. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of people aren't making the commitment to work things out. They're making the commitment, as long as things are good, I'm in, and when we have a bad, it might even be a day or it might be a month or whatever, I'm out of here. And they're taking it very lightly, rather than knowing that things are going to get tough.
And
I'm in here to work this out. I mean, the last thing people do a lot of times is go to counseling. It's not the first thing. Yeah,
so. I agree, and I think that we can talk about people ought to be more committed to each other, or we can talk about the fact that many of us in this culture haven't had a lot of experience with having to stick anything out for anything, to have learned that you can go through pain and come out okay on the other side. There's a real tendency in the culture to avoid pain, whether it's economic, where we see that often, or whether it's relationship. And somehow we need to communicate that message that, you know, if you will put it in religious term, God stays with you through it all, and wait a while, you may come out on that other side. I find as I marry people now, the more and more I am including in that marriage sermon something about commitment. And the same is true in the pre-marriage work that we do with them, which is usually, frankly, if you talk to a lot of pastors, they'll say the pre-marriage work feels useless often. People have already decided. What I'd like to get people 6 to 12 months after they've been married and work with them on how to hold that relationship together now that they've discovered what some of the problems might be.
Judy?
Let me call Diana here.
I picked up a neat book in the bookstore and it's on sale for half price, but it's called Male-Female Continuum, Path to Colleagueship. And at the back of the thing was a pull-out chart that shows the continuum of relationships and how the point at which they can merge, if you want to pull it out.
Great.
But it was $10 book for $5 if anybody's interested. It was on that little rack outside. And it deals with the problem of relationships and where men are at and where women are at and where eventually the relationship should go so that they merge properly. And then you have the proper kind of relationship.
Thank you. A male-female continuum. Yeah.
Well, I think, too, a lot of times when the children get to a certain age, you see a lot of people, then, you know, you stay in it because of the children.
Yes.
And then you look at this person, like I said to my husband, I said, I don't even know who you are. And he goes, what? I mean, because he would never let me really know who he was. Mm-hmm. And I guess my children were a little bit older. I was married 23 years, but it's hard to leave, too, because you know it's safe and to go move on. But I think that some of the people that I know, you're kind of the kids. They're into adolescence now, and they're doing their own thing. And you're not. Then you're kind of seeing your husband more, or your wife, whatever. And then how do you learn how to do things together as a couple when you kind of the children? I mean, children do really.
They hold marriages.
And I have three daughters, and so I was sort of like the Lone Ranger. I mean, I think there's a big difference between relationships between mothers and sons and mothers and daughters.
We don't do a good job of teaching, do we? Of teaching about how to be married and how to be parents. We're kind of working on the parents thing more now, but we don't sit down and really teach each other what holds marriages together. I can remember a couple I knew who always said, we are the center of the marriage, the couple. And the children go around us. Now, there are many people who see marriages as children in the center with the parents on the outer edge. And you have to figure out for yourself which one really holds the marriage together and which one breaks it apart. It's an interesting thought. The church, I think, in kind of winding up here, has a responsibility in this whole process. The people to whom this book is dedicated are a couple with whom I just talked endlessly, bless their hearts, for many weeks and months after the divorce, who just were there and they just listened. And when I came to church on Sunday morning, they saved a seat for me, so I didn't sit alone. If you talk with many single people, they'll tell you that they feel very alone in the church. Some churches are different than others. We may have a higher percentage of single people. But there's a sense among many singles that, well, the church isn't for them. It's family worship and family oriented. So we have a responsibility, I think, to be inclusive and bring people in. Just as when we plan a get-together, I would invite couples in, you know. I've kind of always related to couples, even when I was just an individual. But it didn't always reverse, because when couples are inviting people over, often they invite couples, not individuals, for whatever reason. It's just habit, I think, more than anything. So that the exclusion of singles is not uncommon, and the church has a place, I think, a role to play there in making people feel welcomed at the table and welcomed in the fellowship, in the community.
Well, and I think it depends on the security of the people. I've been single for some time, and I have a neighbor that is just, I just laugh, because they've been married for quite a while, and they have two little adopted kids, and I take care of my lawn, and he takes care of the lawn, and she takes care of things in the house. But whenever he and I are talking over the fence, she yells out for him to come in the house. And I see him talking to other neighbor men, and it's no big deal. So I think a lot of times people see us, and this is, I mean, at the mailbox, we leave for work at the same time, you know, or whatever, and she'll holler at him from the house. And so I just laugh about it, but it's, you know, it's how they perceive us. Our church has a singles group, and it's interdenominational, and it's, so there's a lot of single people that are drawn to go there, but you can see the single people take up two or three rows, and you know, we kind of find each other, and some of them are active in the group, and I'm more what I call mainstream now. I've been in the church choir and done some other things, but I'm still, these are my soul people, you know, or whatever, but.
And some churches find it very unsuccessful to have a singles group, because singles do not want to be singled out. They would rather just be included in.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes, and some of the elderly people in the church, if they see like me and a girlfriend together, they say, oh, you're one of the single gals. And we think, oh, we've got to quit sitting together. You know, we don't want to quite be that either.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to be sort of standing out. Let me just share two more, and then we'll probably be closing here. Psalms. The page is open to Psalms, easily worn by frequent use, and following as they do the book of Job, who also longed to understand. I am revealed in these Psalms, these songs. I lament, weep, cry out in anger, and confront God with my life. And I worship, praise, hope, believe, and trust. Wrapped in these ancient words are all those emotions and thoughts which pass in and out of my life daily. I turn to the time-worn wisdom of God and God's people to find my solace and hope. What I do like about the Psalms is they're so honest. They didn't have divorce, but they, you know, people were allowed to get to hold God accountable. Jesus told us it's not God's intention that we should divorce. It's God's wish that we be one, in marriages, internationally, in families, in friendships, even within ourselves, whole, one, and integrated. God wants our happiness, but we have not been able to fulfill God's wish. We have lived lives of strife, misunderstanding, war, pain, and divorce. We have failed. Jesus told us God's intention, but Jesus came because we fail. We divorce and turn for forgiveness and new life to the one who can help us and bring us back to God. There's just no experience in life that excludes God, and there's no way that God excludes us in terms of forgiveness, understanding, unconditional love. So that divorce becomes one of those, for us, bumps in life. One of those mysteries that those of us who have not been divorced don't quite understand. And one of the challenges, I think, to this society to try to work on relationships in meaningful ways so that people will find and be able to stay in committed relationships and live with that kind of security. And so then we trust all that to God, knowing that we have to play our part in that challenge.